I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Come on now, everybody, get ready for a treat. It's time for stepping out for something mighty good to eat. You looking for atmosphere? Well, they got it happening here. They're doing barbecue the way it ought to be. Bring your sister, brother, significant other. Bring all your pals. There's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.
Bring the whole gang for Al's new grand feast, which includes the new smoking poo-poo platter, 8-stack onions, barbecue nachos, chicken wings, and a whole lot of barbecue meats, baby back ribs, lots of sides, and cornbread. The feast keeps on coming. A whole lot of fun for any type of group get-together. Available in dining room or takeout. Smoking Al's, Massapequa Park. For details, call 516-799-4900. And remember, there's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.
There's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.
But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shortell, and I'm here with co-host and dear friend, producer Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom.
It's
been so exciting here recently.
Yeah.
We've had a number of visits from some of our listeners.
Really?
We had Joe Manfredi stop by with, I believe his fiance is Judy. And they are big listeners. They start their Sunday morning journey to church listening to us.
That's nice.
Sit in the parking lot for a few minutes and then go in and pray.
I don't want to be...
But they're big fans. And
that.
They brought us a bottle of Prosecco that actually has a picture that we took years ago up at PGA.
Really?
With the PGA
trophy.
Trophy. So they had that made for us.
Oh, that's nice.
Bring that to you. And then just yesterday, Bill O'Leary stopped by.
Bill.
And I'm going to present you with a gift that he brought you,
which is
interesting. It looks like a bicycle pump, air pump.
Pump wine opener?
Yeah.
Hold on. Let me see. I got to get this out. All right. Let me show the audience. Hold on. Oh, look at that. Comes in its own little lipstick case and everything.
It's very complicated, though.
Oh, geez. Look out. All right. So what happens?
And then you unscrew that.
Wait, hold on a second. Wait a minute. Let me put that back on.
No, you're supposed to take that off.
That comes off.
Then
I got a little thing.
Right. Now you screw that into...
Screw that into here?
Yeah.
All right. And then I just...
you got to take off the cap.
Take off the cap. Right.
And then if you puncture the cork,
like that,
just
right?
Two or three, I believe, pumps, and this, it brings the cork out of the bottle.
Looks like a cross between a Swiss Army knife and a sex toy. You know, I'm trying to figure this thing out here.
I concur.
All right, let me.
So at any rate,
that's great. Thank you so,
so
much.
So man. We were talking about that. He also brought us some news that Oak Chalet in North Belmore closed over the weekend. I don't know if you were familiar with that restaurant.
I don't know it, no.
So it was
one of the few I don't.
German restaurant. But that be said, I didn't bring the menu in, but it had some items on it that didn't look German. They closed after many, many, many years, and I'm a little disappointed because a bunch of my buddies and I, the band of Undistinguished Gentlemen, were wanting to go there a couple of months ago for lunch. We usually do lunch, but they don't open till 4 o'clock, so we couldn't get it done, and then we forgot about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And sure enough, Sunday, January 4th, the restaurant served its last meal.
You know, I've been saying, thank you, Bill O'Leary, for this. I'm going to put this to good use. You know, who opens more bottles of wine than me? I appreciate that. It's very cool. I like this thing. It's a little pump handle with a needle on it. It's very cool. Anyway, yeah, I've been saying for a long time now that you're witnessing the great shaking out of restaurants on Long Island. I think, you know, for a long time we've had too many. You know, certainly I've been guilty of, you know, opening too many or whatever. But I just think that, you know, from the standpoint of population divided by restaurants, there's too many out there. And there's so many, you know, places and so many options. I mean, I think even like you watch the diners, there was another diner closed in Lynbrook, I believe, over the weekend. I don't know the name of it, but I read about it briefly in the paper. And I think the main reason that you're seeing these diners close is because you have all these bagel shops now and delis and McDonald's has breakfast drive-through windows and Wendy's and all that stuff. I mean, you have all these options where a diner, you actually have to go in, sit down, order, tip, you know, leave. And it's complicated. You know, you go to a bagel store, you get, you know, a bagel or an egg sandwich and, you know, you're in your car eating it on the way to work and it doesn't cost you as much and you don't have to spend the time. So I think from convenience standpoint and everything else, you know, you have a shaking out now. I mean, every strip center has, what, a pizza place, a Japanese restaurant, a Chinese takeout, a deli. You know, they're just inundated with people don't cook anymore, you know.
So I know, but you mentioned bagels, and I still can't get this out of my head. Some reason I'm fixated on that a bagel should cost a quarter.
Well, yeah. Well, good luck with that. You know, tell that to the guy who's making it, you know, he's got to get paid.
The other thing that comes to mind, just since we're talking about my cheapness, is when I go to, say, 7-Eleven. Well, no, when I go to the supermarket and get an apple and it's a dollar.
Right.
Apple should be a quarter, too.
Well, this is the Stu Schrager doctrine.
But an apple being a buck is still, you know, it only went up four times. The bagel, $2.25 or whatever, that's like 10 times.
Let's examine your, what would you call it, neurosis for a minute. Where did this come from? Where did this quarter fixation come from?
Well, obviously I remember it from being young. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking about in the 60s.
Yeah.
I guess you are 50 years later.
Well, I remember working in the 60s. Minimum wage was $1.55 an hour. We have to go back to that.
Actually, it's 65 years later.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, it was. I started working. It was $1.55 an hour for minimum wage. And the first week I worked 90 hours. It was crazy. We were opening a restaurant. And I was a dishwasher, one of three. And I worked 90 hours. And I took home like $87 or something. I thought I was rich. It was crazy. $1.55 an hour. Nuts.
But jump forward to the conversation you were leading about, you know, why all these restaurants are closing and stuff. Yes, there's a lot more choices than there were in yesteryear.
Mm-hmm.
We've also talked about the fact that real estate prices have increased dramatically.
Look, I was listening to a thing on the TV the other day. It said that the average home price in Nassau County is like $800,000 or something. And, you know, Suffolk, it's the high sevens. So everything's kind of nuts. And all the landlords, you know, they got property taxes gone up. And, you know, I feel for them to some degree. I mean, you know, some people are greedy and, you know, whatever that means. You know, they're trying to make as much money as they can on their investments. I get it, you know. But at some point, it's unsustainable. And then that's what you're seeing. You're seeing people, you know, going, listen, if I can't make a dollar, if I have 100 Stu Schragers come in and every day and they want dinner for a quarter, you know, I'm not able to do that, make a living. Why do I have all this risk and I'm not making any reward? And I think you're seeing a lot of that. The risk is outweighing the reward for a lot of people. And, you know, they're questioning why they're doing it. I would do the same thing. I mean, you know, sort of a similar situation at Juul. You know, we were getting sued all the time. You know, slip and fall, this and that, harassment, all the other stuff that goes on. And at some point, you just go, you know what, I'm tired of this. I don't want to do this anymore. This is crazy. It'd be one thing if I'm making $1 million a year, but, you know, we weren't. And, you know, you have all this risk out there. You got lawyers gunning for you, and you get the help is expensive, and the government is up your, you know, back with taxes and fees and everything else, and you get the landlords. It's just that you're getting it from all sides, and people are just getting tired of it. You know, and it's a business where you're kind of forced to work a lot of hours. You know, so you have all this investment in time, money, energy, and whatever. And at the end of the day, there's nothing left. And people are going, why would I do this anymore? This is crazy. And I think a lot of restaurant workers felt the same way. That's why you're having trouble getting help. You know, I had somebody ask me, is it hard to get good help in your business? I said, it's hard to get bad help in my business. It's hard to get any help, you know. After COVID, they all seemed to disappear. I think people just took a different tact and decided that, you know, working, you know, 12, 13, 14 hours a day wasn't what they wanted to do for the rest of their lives. And that's kind of what you do if you're in the restaurant business. And I think the business is trying to rethink all of that. You know, there are people that are, you know, have some progressive thoughts on how that should happen. And, you know, I'm kind of like interested in hearing it and seeing what happens. I, you know, look at how many people are closing now on Monday and Tuesday. How many restaurants, you know, open only 5 days a week? That was unheard of 10 years ago. You know, diners open at 9 in the morning and close at 9 at night now. That was unheard of 20 years ago. They were all 24 hours. You can get whatever you want 24 hours a day. So everybody's rethinking the model, you know. And I don't think the model that we all kind of grew up with and know from the restaurant industry doesn't really work anymore. And it has to do with, you know, there's a lot of factors, you know, cost factors and help factors or whatever. But I think you're going to continue to see a lot of shaking out until, you know, A, the economy gets to the point where people are more confident in what's going to happen in the future. And, you know, prices start to come down. Well, you're seeing it with gas now. You know, I passed a gas station the other day that had gas for $2.59.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, that's a good dollar less than it was a year ago, you know. So there are signs pointing in the right direction. But perception is reality, and the perception is right now that the economy sucks. So until that perception is turned around, people hold back. You know, they're afraid to spend, and, you know, and they don't know where it's going to go.
That's true. That's true.
That's my dissertation on it.
So other exciting news. It's Girl Scout cookie time.
Oh, my God. I love those.
Yes.
I think that's kind of nature's gift to the world. And, you know, it's funny, I don't eat them as much as I used to. I love every one that they make. I mean, there's not a bad Girl Scout cookie ever made. And generally when I pass a table, you know, out front of a store or something, you know, you see a bunch of little kids with the cookies. I always buy like maybe 10 or 12 boxes, and then I give them to the girls who sold them to me to bring them home because I don't trust myself. If I bring them home, I'll eat all 10 boxes.
Well, again, I always find something to get crazed about, and I'm crazed because 2 years ago, a couple of years ago, they introduced Raspberry Rally, which was like a thin mint, but it had a raspberry
flavor,
centric taste or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was a one and go.
Really? They probably didn't, you know, I'm sure they do research on.
People were selling them on eBay at inflated prices.
What, more than a quarter?
I think a box of Girl Scout cookies is $5 or something.
I don't know. I just get the bill at the end
of the day. But they were selling them for $20. Not the Girl Scouts, the third-party people.
Yeah, yeah.
But this year, they have another new edition. It's called Explore-mores. And I've given you one. I don't know if you had a chance to taste it.
I haven't. No,
but
I'm
it's a Rocky Road ice cream-inspired cookie filled with flavors of chocolate, marshmallow, and toasted almond cream.
It sounds like a grand entrance to a diabetic coma here.
So I've tasted it, and I don't taste the almond that they're talking about. Do you?
Yeah. Yeah, I get the almond thing in the background. They're very good.
So
there's four more in here. Keep your hands off them, all right?
So at any rate, be ready, Long Island. The
the Nassau County and Suffolk County Girl Scouts will be out and about selling their wares.
Yeah, I just had a breakfast s'more. Oh, not good. It's not good to eat and talk at the same time. I'm trying to get this down. Anyway, so at the end of the month, I'm heading to Napa.
Really?
Yeah, my second trip in 20 years. I hadn't been going there for a long time. I was going the other way. I was going to Europe, you know. But I'm starting to reacquaint myself with a lot of the California wines. I'm not a huge fan of California Reds. Only because I think that it's not my, you know, flavor profile that I'm looking for. And it's not like they don't make good wine out there. They do. But most of it is very ripe, and I don't get a lot of nuance with some of the wines out there. But I went a couple of years ago with my daughter. We were chasing down some Cabernets that were a little less alcohol, and they were very good. David Arthur was very good. Cardinale was very good. A little higher alcohol than Cardinale, but you don't taste it. So I'm going out again, and I've been tasting some Pinot Noirs that I like and some Chardonnays that I like out there. So there's a whole genre of, it's called The New Wine of California. There's a book called The New Wine of California. I just read it about a year ago. And he lists a bunch of like boutique little wineries that are making wine like old world style wine, where the guy is out in a vineyard and working it and, you know, checking the Brix levels and, you know, doing the vineyard management thing and then, you know, making these wines in the winery himself and not like these corporate, you know, like the Camuses and the Mondavis. And they make the wines fine, don't get me wrong, but they make it in such large batches. It's not really artisan wines like these are. And he has a couple of, you know, examples in it. It's probably about 15 to 20 wineries that he lists in there that are making these kinds of wines. So I'm going to go out and I'm going to check some of them out and, you know, see what happens. And then, of course, the last night I'm going to spend in San Francisco because it's a little closer to the airport. I don't feel like driving, you know, a long way on the last day. So, you know, there's a place I go to San Francisco called La Mar, L-A, new word, M-A-R. In Spanish, it means the sea. And they do probably some of the best Peruvian food I've ever tasted. And, you know, for those who aren't familiar with Peruvian cuisine, they have a huge Asian influence down there. I guess there's a big Japanese community in Peru, and their flavors and their culture of food is seeped into the Peruvian culture. And it's really a very cool, it's called Nikkei cuisine, N-I-K-E-I, I think it is, but K-K-I-E-I. Anyway, they have this, you know, like amalgamated, you know, fusion between Latin flavors and the Japanese flavors. And it's very cool. They do some of the best ceviches I've ever had. So I'm excited to go there. And the problem is they're only open for dinner. So I have to make sure I get there like right at 5 o'clock when they open and then have some ceviche and maybe one or two things off the menu and then go to dinner, you know, like at 8:30 when that calms down a little bit, you know. You know, if you put them too closely together, you know, you don't really enjoy the one because you're stressed out about the other one, and you get there and you're full and you're ordering food that you know. Anyway, so it's complicated. You know, this is a first world problem I have here, by the way.
I understand.
You know, I'm not complaining. So I got to find a second restaurant. I'm tempted to go to Catonia, which is a very cool Italian restaurant right next to Quince, which is a very high-end. He's owned by the same people. I was going to go to Quince, but I couldn't get a reservation. It booked up already. And it's amazing to me. You know, you go to cities like New York and, you know, L.A., San Francisco, and they have these huge restaurants with big Michelin star ratings and, you know, big prices. I mean, you know, some of them are like $450, $500 a head, you know, before drinks. And, you know, you're going to spend $1,200, $1,500 for two people. It's a lot of money for dinner. They're booked months in advance. It's crazy. I mean, there's still a market for that. And, you know, this goes back to the closings. You know, it seems to me that the higher-end restaurants always kind of survive, you know, because people who have that kind of money generally don't cook. Or if they do, when they go out, they have enough money to afford, you know, the higher-end prices. And the really lower end stuff, like the McDonald's, you know, they're always around because they're affordable and whatever. You can feed a whole bunch of people, you know, a lot of bad food. It's the people in the middle that are struggling all the time. They're, you know, they can't get the price, you know. And so if you can't get the price, you can't buy the quality. You can't have the quality. It doesn't taste the same as the expensive restaurant. They're in a real, like, kind of a, you know, circling down a drain, quagmire, you know, with, you know, do I price it this way and lose money? Do I price it the other way and lose customers? It's one of the reasons they're closing. It's a mess. You know, it's going to have to all get sorted, as they say in England.
So when you do this wine journey, you're doing it to add to your selection at your various properties, or is it just a personal voyage?
All of the above. You know, all of the above. I like to go, excuse me, taste new things, you know, things I may have not had before. And I like to retaste some stuff, you know, because the great part about wine is every year it's different. So, like, we'll take this place, Kenzo, for example. I'm going to Kenzo on I guess it's Wednesday morning, the 27th or whatever. And Kenzo's an interesting property because it was bought by, the property was bought by a Japanese fella. He's like the Bill Gates of Japan. This guy made all his money with gaming, I guess video games and stuff. And he's an extremely wealthy guy. I'm told that property prices in Napa are about $2 million an acre. And he bought like 3,800 acres. So, you know, do the math. It's a whole bunch of money, right? And he's got this high mountain vineyard. And he brought in like a Hall of Fame team of people to work with him. I think Heidi Barrett makes the wine. David Abreu works the vineyard. You know, if you're not familiar with these names, these are big, big names in Napa. Anyway, he makes this fabulous wine. And it's expensive. I mean, wholesale, you know, I think the Sauvignon Blanc, he makes one white, he makes a Sauvignon Blanc, and that's maybe $100 a bottle, you know, which is expensive for Sauvignon Blanc wholesale. Rest of his stuff starts at like, you know, $180, $200 a bottle. It's very expensive. Most of his wines go to Japan. You know, he's got a big market over there. Probably 60% of his wines get exported. The other 40% are here. And the wines are stellar. I mean, they're phenomenally good wine. You know, it's just that they're so pricey that A, they're hard to sell from the standpoint of a wine list, and B, there's not a lot of it around, so it's hard to get. You know, it's allocated, so I can get it, you know, through the restaurant for sure. But, you know, with all the good wine out there at prices that are a little above a quarter, you know, but they're you know, there's some inexpensive wine that tastes really good out there, you know. So to start spending $200, $300 on a bottle, it's precious, you know, for some people, you know, me included. I mean, you know, I drink enough wine where if I spent $200 on every bottle, I'd be broke in a month, you know. So I'm excited to taste the new releases. And getting back to that, you know, every year it's different. So although I do know the wines and I've had them over the years, I like to taste the current releases and see what they are.
And then how do you take it forward? because I know that I've come to visit you and you've had salespeople carry cases of wine into your restaurant for sampling,
right?
And then you choose what you want or whatever, and mm-hmm. they deliver it to you.
Yeah.
But now, when you're dealing with the vineyard directly,
no,
or they're going to put you in charge, in touch with their distributor, or the distributor you already know.
Yeah, wholesale, you can't. You're not allowed to do that. You have to go through the distributors. There's rules and regulations about how much they can charge and how much discount they can give you and all kinds of stuff. It's kind of funny because the state, you know, and the government itself gets its nose into everything. It's always about tax money, whatever. But you know what's funny to me about government? Government does very few things well. The only thing I think that they do real well is they collect money. You know, they're very good at finding money. If you have $25 under your pillow, they'll find it somehow and tax you on it. You know, there's incentives sometimes to buy certain wines. They'll give discount on a five-case buy, you know, like a volume buy. And but there are rules and regulations on it. There's, you know, the government says you can only do that on the month of February, or you can't, you know, discount more than this amount of money on this wine. And I don't know where they get off, you know, getting involved in all of that. They don't do, like I said, they don't do it very well. So it is what it is. But it is against the law. I can't really go directly to the vineyard. I can on Long Island because Long Island has salespeople they don't go. Some wines don't go through distributors here, so you can buy, you know, wine through the vineyard itself. But yeah, generally, if they're, you know, coming in from California, they're usually coming in through a distributor. And Europe, same, whatever. But it's kind of fun to go out there and bang through some of the vineyards, because, like I said, you don't get to taste everything. And I should say this. You know, I probably taste 400 or 500 wines a year, maybe even more. And the reason for that is you have salesmen coming. I have salesmen coming every week or two. I'll have two or three people. I probably use 10 or 15 different salespeople, because they all have different books, you know, the wines that they sell. And so they'll come in and they'll taste me out. And like twice a year in the spring and the fall, the distributors have their grand tastings where they open up everything in their portfolio, and you get to go into the city or out to the Hamptons, wherever they're doing it, and you can taste through all their wines. So it sounds like tasting 500 wines a year is, you know, you're sitting there under a lamppost, you know, drunk and stupid, but, you know, you're spitting, but it's an interesting way to kind of see what's out there. And so I've been doing this now for probably 40 years, maybe even more, maybe 50 at this point, but 40 for sure. So if you take 500-600 wines a year times 40 years, you know, I have a pretty good idea what's out there. And for me, that's a lot of fun, because I pass that information off to my customers through my wine list. I'd like to think I choose very interesting wines and wines of high quality and wines that represent the price very well. And there's value in all of them. I mean, there's value in the $8 glass, and there's value in the $38 glass, you know. And also, I like to pass the information on, A, through the radio station, and B, through some wine talks and seminars that I give. You know, it's kind of fun. So for me, it's a subject. I mean, don't get me wrong, I like the buzz. I mean, we wouldn't be drinking wine if we didn't. But the bottom line is, it's more of an interesting subject matter for me to chew on, discuss, taste. And wine is fun to drink with other people. Like, I guess scotch is the same way. You know, I don't know. I don't drink spirits. But I never see, you know, a bunch of guys sitting around and discussing the vodka, you know. Hey, what are you getting that vodka? Nothing. It tastes like alcohol, you know. And some vodkas taste better than others, I guess. But it's not like wine. Wine has such nuance in it that it's interesting to talk about. It's not fun to drink alone, you know, wine. Although sometimes I force myself. But the bottom line is, it's much more fun in a crowd, because you get all these different opinions. And I've even seen people almost come to blows over the finish on a late harvest Gewurztraminer, to me, which is beyond my comprehension how you get violent over wine. But yeah, some people are passionate. It's crazy.
Wow. So, just a random question. If you surveyed people, you know, would you rather eat a hot dog or a hamburger? What type of responses do you think you would get?
I think you'd probably get 75 to 80% hamburger, I would guess. You know, nobody really knows what's in a hot dog, you know, so you're kind of going in blind a little bit. And the nitrite thing, I think, is big in people's minds to some degree.
So here's some comments when people were asked that question. One person said there are a number of good burger joints out there, but few that serve
hot dogs.
Hot dogs.
Yeah. So you got to go to Chicago for that.
So that's actually very true. There's, you know, you late night, you can go get a hamburger at Wendy's, McDonald's, yeah. Burger King. No hot dogs. And that's always interesting to me, is why those places never had a hot dog on their menu.
There's a place in the city called Criff Dogs. Have you ever been there?
No.
It's in the village. I think it's on 8th, maybe, 7th or 8th. And it's pretty cool. I mean, they got all kinds of, you know, shenanigans going on the hot dog thing. That's fun.
Another person said, you know, always a hamburger. But if I'm at Costco, that $1.50 hot dog and a drink, I can't say no.
Are you related to him?
Maybe. Another person goes, whichever one is vegan. Another person goes, I love both, but it depends on my mood. One person goes, hamburgers, but no fries. Who says hamburgers have to come with fries?
The whole world.
Somebody said they can't make a decision, so they have both. And then there was another interesting question or statement that move over ketchup. So hot dog toppings are only limited by your imagination, it goes on to say. Your your options may be influenced by where you live, as it seems every region has a different take on the hot dog. So I'm now reading this thing. I'm saying, why is it saying move over ketchup? Because when I think of a hot dog, I think of mustard.
Yeah, me too.
So at any rate,
ketchup on a hot dog is sacrilegious.
Right. So there are countless blog posts where you can find hot dog recipes showing off different flavors or themes.
Mm-hmm.
Take, for example, the Hawaiian hot dog with pineapple salsa and teriyaki sauce, or the Mexican hot dog with grilled onions, tomatoes, and jalapenos. Hot dogs with Indian masala or Mediterranean products are out there. And there's a lot of different things.
Don't tell me there's a Greek hot dog with feta cheese and olives. I'll throw up.
No, they didn't mention that.
Yeah, thank God.
But
no, listen, it's all fun. I mean, hot dog is a fun food. It's not to be taken seriously. There are people that make their own. I know a guy who started this whole hot dog thing out in Vegas. You know, he makes his own hot dogs and sausages, and he does a great job, and they taste good. And, 100% beef, the whole thing. It's kind of a calling, but one I wouldn't be interested in. But the bottom line is, hot dogs are fun food. It's not to be taken seriously, and you can top them with whatever you want. I mean, I've seen, we used to make this thing called the home wrecker at Jewel, and it was a home wrecker because I called it that because people told me they would have some gas issues after they would eat it, right? And I had chili on it, I had an egg on it, it was like jalapenos on there, there was salsa on it, that thing was weighed about a pound and a half, and it was $15 or whatever, and we sold a fair amount of them, but again, it's hot dogs are fun, so I'm good with where I'm completely against pineapple pizza. I'm okay with pineapple salsa on a hot dog because it's pork. And pork and pineapple go together. Pork has always been a good vehicle for, fruit salsas. Or if you look at, German dishes, right? They serve pork with applesauce all the time, or grilled peaches or grilled plums. So I think it's a natural, topping that you could put on it. And, other than feta cheese, which I think would be a disaster, I think, you can do, like what I do, that Wisp Pride or whatever, that melted cheddar stuff, that they use on nachos. All of that stuff, it's all in play. I mean, my advice would be go have fun with it. Top it with whatever you want, Because, you're killing yourself by eating these things. You might as well have fun doing it, there are hot dog places in Chicago that I've been in, and they also have an array of sausages. They have bratwurst there, and they have these linguica and merguez and different sausages. So a hot dog is just basically a sausage. It's a mild one for sure, but it's a sausage. And those things are fun. I mean, people have put roasted peppers and onions and mustard and ketchup and everything on it for years. Go get them, do whatever you want.
It's funny, my only recollection of a thematic hot dog was I was at a music festival down in Florida a couple of years ago, and we were walking around, and there was a hot dog stand. But again, not your normal New York dirty dog, dog.
Yeah, yeah.
It had all these different toppings or whatever, and I do remember something. I thought it was really good. I didn't think I would enjoy it, but it was, I guess it was almost like a pineapple salsa or something.
Uh-huh.
But then it had like potato sticks across.
Really? Yeah,
the,
yeah.
I don't know. It was an interesting mix. So I have to say I fell into it, but I still would have trouble with Hawaiian pizza, which usually ham and pineapple on a.
I don't care what people eat, obviously, eat whatever you want, but I don't know. There's something about pineapples and tomatoes. It just, it's a fruit that doesn't mix with the other fruit.
But when I start thinking about hot dogs, but when we were talking about German cuisine earlier, Platt Deutsch is one of the restaurants that we had them as a guest, I believe, one year.
Uh-huh.
But they brought in a bratwurst platter.
Uh-huh.
Or a wurst sampler, because there's all different types. There's bratwurst, knockwurst. They had something called kreinerwurst.
But the,
you know, those are the best of the worst.
Well, the bratwurst is just a normal, it's like a fat sausage, right?
Yeah. Well, it's, yeah, it's good.
And then I don't know what the difference is between a knockwurst.
Knockwurst is a big fat hot dog, essentially.
And what's the difference between bratwurst?
Well, bratwurst is seasoned differently.
Oh, okay. And then they had the Kreinerwurst, which was a smoky, often cheese-filled sausage.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, the Germans are known. Sausages and beer and pork, you know, you know, a lot of pork over there. I like that food. It's fun to me. I mean, it's fat and salt. Like, you
what's
know.
The Irish thing? Bangers and...
Bangers and mash? That's English, I think.
English?
Yeah, that's sausages and potato. Yeah, they got odd ones over there. Cocky leaky, that soup, you know. what else they have? Bangers and mash and haggis. Haggis is made of everything that you don't want to eat. It's like, you know, a bunch of... You know, kidney and offal, they call it, you know. I call it awful. They call it offal, you know. You say tomato, I say tomato. It's, anyway, yeah, it's, look, you know, people, they're trying, you know, in the pursuit to use the whole animal, you know, this is where all this stuff was born, hot dogs and stuff. It was all pieces of the animal that nobody wanted, so they mush it together and make it. What they always say, you don't want to know how sausage is made, you know. It's kind of probably true.
So let me throw this at you. We don't normally talk about breakfast foods,
mm-hmm.
But very popular today are egg bites, which essentially, if I'm understanding it, it's a scrambled egg that's like made in a like a muffin tin.
No, I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about.
So that you whip your egg or whatever.
No, I know how to make it. I get that part. But egg, would they sell them frozen or something? Or?
They sell them frozen.
Oh, okay. I got it now.
And it's all the trend to make them at home or whatever.
Yeah, we do. I do these mini quiches sometimes for ladies, you know, in a breakfast buffet, and we'll make like a little quiche, or, you know, a frittata, if you will. In a little egg muffin cup, you know, and it comes out. It's a nice little round thing, you know. Good presentation, and they're fun. I mean, that's, you know, that's cool stuff. I mean, I think for breakfast. I'm not a breakfast guy. I rarely eat it, almost never. I'm more of a European kind of breakfast guy. I'd rather have cheese and prosciutto or you know, smoked salmon or something like that, some kind of protein. I'm not a big egg guy, so I don't really... pursue the breakfast thing, and I don't eat pancakes or any of that stuff.
Right. So, I mean, although it might not be a personal favor of yours, but I guess if you're doing something as a brunch, usually you find either, well, you always find omelets usually,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Then you go into, you know, French toast, a waffle, pancakes. So what's the Tom Shawdell take on that so that people leave saying, wow, that was different? Well you don't want them to be different.
You know what's funny is that people's tastes and volume of eating have changed so drastically over the last 10 or 12 years. I remember years ago you put a buffet out and you know, the rule of thumb was you needed about one tray of food for every 10 people. And it's kind of funny, but they don't eat like they used to. I remember going to some of these buffets at golf outings, you know, at a country club where, you know, the place is swimming and lobsters and, you know, clams and all this, that, and the other thing. When I do a raw bar now, I basically only need one piece of each shellfish per person. I guess some people don't like oysters, some people like them a lot, whatever happens. But it comes down to about, if I have 100 people, I need 100 oysters and 100 clams. And then, you know, shrimp is different. They eat a lot more of that. But the bottom line is they don't eat the volume that they used to do. People are more careful, even on buffets. You know, so we do a lot of breakfast buffets for golf tournaments and things like that. They don't eat a lot of pancakes. They don't eat a lot of French toast. They don't eat a lot of big carbs. Believe it or not, they don't eat a lot of breakfast sausage. I'm trying to rethink all of that. I was talking to Don, the manager, who is actually leaving the club, sadly. But... He and I have been, you know, what do we do? What do we do to make this different? What do we do that they're going to eat? You know, they eat a lot of smoked salmon. They eat a lot of omelets, for sure. But, you know, bacon, still, they eat a lot of bacon. Sausages, not so much. Pancakes, not so much. And you always feel like you have to have them. The only time I really sell pancakes is if I make them in front of, if I do it in front of the audience. I'll do like a lemon and regatta, some interesting pancake. We'll sell those. Or kids sometimes, you know, kids have chocolate chip pancakes. But they don't eat a lot of them, believe it or not.
What about like Eggs Benedict and stuff
yeah,
like that?
That stuff goes, you know. I do it a little differently now. I don't use hollandaise so much anymore for two reasons. One, it's hard to keep, you know, if you're going to have a buffet that's an extended amount of time, you're going to have to keep replenishing, you know, the Eggs Benedict. And hollandaise doesn't hold very well. And there's always that element of, you know, kind of raw eggy thing in there. So I do this stuff called comeback sauce that I make with smoked tomatoes and mayonnaise and mustard, and whatever, some tomato puree. And I use that on it instead. And it has a little more pop than hollandaise has. It's not quite as traditional, but I think people like it better, actually.
So when you put out the salmon, smoked salmon on a buffet for a golf outing, do people automatically put it on a bagel or they eat it separately? Or
all of the above, you know. I don't eat a lot of, I try not to eat a lot of carbs. If I go to one of those buffets, generally what I eat is smoked salmon and fruit. Unless I like to smoke salmon, but I just do some capers or whatever and take it like a man stew. Nothing on it, you know. But, you know, people, yeah, they make sandwiches and, you know, bagel sandwiches and stuff, which is fun, you know.
It's funny because you say people watch what they eat. So the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur is when we fast for essentially 24 hours.
Sure.
And then when you break the fast, it's traditionally smoked fish and bagels.
Yeah, lighter food, eggs and stuff. Yeah.
But usually there's so many delicacies there that I want to forego the bagel. So I'll take a dollop of cream cheese, take some slices of the smoked salmon, and sort of just use it as the cream cheese as a dipping sauce in
a
sense.
A deconstructed salmon sandwich. No, smoked salmon to me is just, it's one of the, when it's really done well, and there are different quality, you know, levels of smoked salmon. I've had some stuff out of Ireland that's just unbelievably good, you know, smoked with champagne and orange and, you know, like, there's some guys out there with some imagination, which is kind of cool. And a pastrami smoked salmon, which was a David Burke thing. You know, that's fun. You know, those things are really fun.
Is that what they call Gravlax?
Gravlax is cured. It's not smoked. So that's the difference. Smoked salmon is smoked, cold smoked. Gravlax is cured with sugar and salt and herbs or whatever. You know, sometimes they'll throw a little vodka in there or, you know, anise-flavored liqueur. Aquavit is used a lot, you know. I prefer the Gravlax. I like them. They tend to have a little more flavor. When you smoke things, the smoke sometimes overpowers anything you can do as far as flavor goes. Although that orange and champagne smoke salmon.
That sounds intriguing.
Yeah,
so many times they'll serve smoked salmon with crumbled hard-boiled egg.
Yeah.
Is that something that goes anywhere in your mind?
I don't get it. You know, I mean, it's just something else to throw on there, I guess. But it's, I mean, how do you eat that, really, you know? You're not going to put that on a sandwich, I wouldn't think.
No, but again, it's almost like a dipping type.
It's a garnish.
Yeah, it's a garnish.
Yeah.
And just like you were saying with the capers, sometimes, if I'm not mistaken, might be some minced onion.
Yeah, yeah. No, I kind of get all of that. I don't get that. I think that what I'm trying to do, especially at the club, is to rethink what they've done all these years. When Don and I got to the club, I mean, we reshaped the culture of that country club almost to the point of unrecognizability. Because, you know, we don't do the whole country club cooking thing, you know, the roast chicken with the baked potato and, you know, the prime rib dinner on Saturday. You know, we run it more like a three-star restaurant. And the wine list has changed, you know, completely. So what I'm trying to do there is rethink things that are almost Pavlovian in their application, you know, like, you know, can we get a crudité platter? You can get one, but a crudité platter, you know what that is to me? That's minestrone soup for the next 2 days because nobody eats it, you know? I got all these vegetables cut up and I got a dip and, you know, you got one vegetarian out there would stick the thing in and, you know, and eat a carrot, you know? It's like, why are we doing this? You know, how about we grill a platter of vegetables with a nice, like, vinaigrette on it or something like that, where they have some flavor, you know? There's, I mean, raw carrots, okay, I guess. But, you know, wouldn't you rather have a grilled carrot that has, like, a, you know, lavender honey on it or something, or some kind of a, you know, vinaigrette? So we're trying to rethink all of these things. The pancakes, again, I started making different flavored pancakes, whole wheat pancakes, you know, lemon regatta pancakes, you know, with blueberry sauce and whatever. And you see people perk up for that, you know? It's not the same old, you know, here it is, you know, it's the American breakfast. You got eggs, you got pancakes, you got French toast, you got waffles. Nobody cares about that anymore, you know? They're looking for interesting things.
So when you say interesting, and that, for some reason, my mind went to crepes and blintzes. Mm-hmm. What's the difference between a blintzer and a crepe?
Crepe is thinner, you know, and it's bigger. You know, crepes aside, you have 6 inches, 8 inches, whatever. You have bigger ones, you know. I've seen huge ones. But blintzes are usually smaller, and they're, like, thicker.
Yes. You know? You see, when you're when you're saying that, it clicks.
Yeah, and they're usually wrapped around something that's, you know, like cheese in there. There's some kind of a...
Sometimes a fruit.
Yeah, the blueberry or whatever. Yeah, that's another thing, you know. I do a breakfast at the club, which is kind of fun for me. You know, I get into the whole Jewish soul food thing 2 or 3 times a year, you know, which I don't get to do normally during the season because it's not a big call for it. But I have a good time with it, except for the chopped liver. It's disgusting. But the rest of it, I mean, matzo ball soup, you know, I think I make a pretty good one. It's fun. It's fun to do something you haven't done. And we always make blintzes, and nobody eats them. It's like hilarious, you know. If I have 100 people, I'll sell maybe, I don't know, 15, you know, 15, 20 maybe they'll take.
But a blintzer, it definitely is a food of yesteryear, isn't it?
Totally, yeah. Well, that's it. We've moved on from certain things, you know. We've moved on from French onion soup on every menu. You know, we've moved on from, you know, if you take the 70s, everybody had a French onion soup, right? Everybody had a steak tidbits on garlic bread with melted mozzarella. There was all these, you know, kind of pub foods that were standard issue on every menu, at least on Long Island. And then in the 80s, it all changed. It all changed thanks to, you know, Wolfgang Puck and Alice Waters and Jeremiah Tower and all these chefs out in L.A. that said, you know what? We're not doing this anymore. We're going to use fresh stuff that's grown here. We're going to have an American cuisine. And, you know, they changed the way the whole world thought about, or at least this country thought about food.
So what you were just saying, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier in the show, the Oak Chalet. So I mentioned that there were some items on the menu that didn't seem German to me.
Yeah.
And something you just said got my mind to that again. So I went and looked up the menu. And so Oak Chalet, which is known as a German restaurant, appetizers, flatbreads.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't see that. Chicken liver pate, yes. Herring filet and wine sauce, yes.
Oh, my God.
But then they go to baked clams.
You have a sushi bar? I'm waiting for the sushi bar.
Broiled scampi.
Oh, boy.
So I don't see those as... I don't get it.
You know, it's a loss of identity. Look, German restaurants are going the way of the Whigs because, you know, that food's heavy and it's not the way we eat anymore. But, I mean, if you're going to have one, like the Village, what's it called, the Village Lantern,
yeah.
Yeah, down in they're hardcore.
Lindenhurst.
They're hardcore. They stick to the program. You know, they got like Oompa bands in there and, you know, you got people sitting at the bar drinking beers.
Now, understand, I'm not critiquing that the items that I said aren't German descent don't taste good. There's no question. It's probably unbelievable.
Yeah.
But it's I guess there's two types of customers. There's the person that's, you know, every so often goes in and enjoys the restaurant because it's German cuisine.
Sure.
Then there's the family that goes once a month, every, you know, this one Sunday every month.
Yeah.
And they're in there. And again, it's not, I guess it's not a thematic restaurant to them.
Yeah.
It's a restaurant, and they like choices.
Would you go eat at Mama Goldberg's Pizza? There's a perception about, you know, and I'm making an extreme point, but the bottom line is I'm not going to a German restaurant and ordering the lasagna. I'm just not going to do it. you know, I want the pork. I want the, you know, the sauerbraten or whatever. I want a representation of what you're representing here, you know. It's just, it's nuts. I mean, there's an Italian restaurant. I know it's a pretty good Italian restaurant. He's got a sushi bar in it. It's like mind-boggling. I'm like, where does it end? it's, and I guess it works for him. And, you know, God bless you. You know, I don't, you know, I'm certainly not going to tell you how to run your business. I have enough trouble running my own. But, you know, at some point, I don't know, it just seems, you know, when you're trying to be all things to everybody, I'm not so sure it works out that way. You know, the steak and sushi to me is, it makes a lot of sense because it's steak and it's surf and turf. I get it. You know, they kind of go hand in hand. You know, it's an abstract version of the original lobster tail and filet mignon thing. But, you know, lasagna and nigiri, I don't know. It's a little bit of a stretch. And, you know, they have their own, you know, Italians have crudo, which is, you know, I guess perfectly acceptable at that point. So maybe, I don't know, maybe there's a, you know, a correlation there. I mean, you have rice and you have risotto. I guess, I don't know. It just seems to me that, you know, if I'm going to do an Italian restaurant, I want to represent Italian food the best I can, not Japanese, even if some of the, you know, ingredients kind of, you know, commingle or whatever.
Wait, so that's an interesting thing. So that just got me thinking about something. So it sort of coordinates, but not. So you said, would I go somewhere?
Goldberg's Pizza.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. So would you go to Shmuka Bernstein's for Chinese food? So Shmuka Bernstein was a Lower East Side restaurant that happened to have a menu of Chinese themed foods, but it was kosher.
I would go there, but only on a Sunday. And Christmas. I would go on Christmas and I would go on a Sunday. Because who knows more about Chinese food on a Sunday or Christmas than the Jewish population? I mean, you know, the whole thing is, yeah, it's kind of funny. And I get it. And I think that if you had a Mama Goldberg's Pizza, you would have to say, it's like years ago, I had this idea. I was going to put, I had a restaurant I was going to do, and on a sign I was going to put warm beer and lousy food. Just as a kind of wink and nod, saying that this is the coldest beer, and you know, and it better be cold, and the food better be great, you know. And it's the same thing when, you know, was it Schmooky something you said there?
I believe it was Shmuka Bernstein.
Shmuka Bernstein's, you know, Chinese food. You know, it almost makes you think, you know, hey, let me try that just to see what's going on. But at the end of the day, I mean, there'll be a lot of people who go, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't think that's a good idea. And it's the same thing with my son, warm beer and lousy food. Some people will go, yeah, no kidding, I ain't going there, you know.
So it was a restaurant. It really was a restaurant from like 1950 to 1990. Shmuka Bernstein was around for a very long time. But it was on Essex Street, which was the, you know, the Lower East Side and...
It's, yeah, you know, it's, look, the restaurant business is, there's a lot of different ways to attack it, and I certainly don't condemn anybody for their ideas. Some of them might think are far-fetched, but that's, you know, I'm not right about it all. Listen, I've had my share of foibles also, you know.
So I'm going to throw something out to our audience. If you do not know, you can reach us at fire@whli.com, fire@whli.com. Our sister radio station, KJOY 98.3, recently had a food prep night over at Mulcahy's in Wantagh. And,
is that the one I was disinvited to?
No, you were invited to. But because of that, I brought up to the powers to be at the radio station about possibly doing a cooking demo, a food prep night featuring you, Tom Shordell.
Oh, my God.
And I was wondering what our audience thought about doing an event like that. We could really make it an interesting night because we can exploit Tom and his cooking, his music, and his literary efforts.
Well, this sounds like a great idea to me. I'm going to have to be working pretty hard that night.
You would be.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
So I just curious if the audience would be interested in coming out. And is this something that would have to be a Sunday afternoon? Or is it convenient for our listeners to get out like on a Thursday night? And, you know, where are more of our listeners from? Suffolk, Nassau,
Brooklyn, Queens, who knows?
Yeah, I know. It'd be interesting to find out. I don't know. How do you find out demographics of a radio show?
Well,
Arbitron or something?
I can do it by station. It's hard to find out by show.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You know, that's why we have this communication channel, which is fire@whli.com. I know that, you know, I've been to a couple of your pairing nights, which are really cool because not only do you get great wine, food, you usually get insight on it. I know I've been out to out east, and I don't think it was Allure. But McCall's was present.
It was Amano.
Amano.
Yeah.
And we had the owner talk about his vineyard and gave some insight into the different wines. But at the same time, when you've done some things yourself, I'll never forget the birthday night. And, you know, you were in the kitchen, you were playing music, and you were in the dining room just discussing what you paired with the food and the wine.
It was a fun night. Yeah, it's look, I try and do these things from an educational standpoint, and, you know, sometimes Long Island kind of fights you on that, and it's not just Long Island. It's usually the more affluent places, like the East Coast, the West Coast, or whatever. You don't find it so much in the middle of the country, but, you know, I started doing these chef's tables at the club, and, you know, I put out a letter from the kitchen to the members that, you know, I'm doing a chef's table. It's going to be 7-8 courses with matching wines, this, that, and the other thing. And I want this to be educational as much as I want it to be fun. You know, I'd like to give you different, you know, aspects of food you may not have had, wines you may not have tasted, you know, fun night for everybody. And I was looking for a specific customer, you know, somebody who was interested in food and wine and who wanted to, you know, kind of try new things. And it started out that way, and then it got to, well, you know, we like to do this, but Mary can't have scallops, and John's allergic to dairy, and Jennifer can't eat fish. And it just became, you know, it's hard to do a menu for 8 or 10 people when you're doing 7 courses. You have 70 different plates. If 35 of them are completely different, you know, it throws a monkey wrench into the gear shift there, you know. And so I actually stopped doing it because it became such a pain in the neck. And, you know, I was doing it on Friday nights when we're doing dinner anyway. So it was kind of a high wire act. And, you know, to have that on top of now I got 7 different substitutions. I don't know who was the one who didn't like the dairy again and who had a gluten allergy, you know. So it became this thing that, you know, kind of collapsed on itself to some degree. We're bringing it back with the understanding that, you know, if you have certain food allergies, phobias, whatever, this dinner just may not be the one for you. You know, let's wait for the one for you to come, you know. Well, we'll do something like that, and I have no problem. Just come in and order, you know, come in and order regular dinner. We're happy to accommodate all those things. But when you're doing a dinner for 8 or 10 people and it's like, you know, that many courses, it's kind of hard to, you know, kind of, you know, get everybody happy at the same time. Listen, talk about happy. We got to get out of here because it's time.
Really?
Time
flies.
So let's thank Smoke and Al quickly, right?
Yes.
I love Smoke and Al, and he's sponsored this show now for a while. And get yourself there. It's my favorite barbecue restaurant on Long Island, if not the world. He does a great job down there.
My band of undistinguished gentlemen are supposed to be dining there.
All right. So we're going to close the show with Tom's 3 keys to life. His life is too short to spend 25 cents on a bagel. Drink, treat every meal like it was your last, and keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. And we're all going to try and get some therapy for Stu.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Come on now, everybody, get ready for a treat. It's time for stepping out for something mighty good to eat. You looking for atmosphere? Well, they got it happening here. They're doing barbecue the way it ought to be. Bring your sister, brother, significant other. Bring all your pals. There's
There's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.
Bring the whole gang for Al's new grand feast, which includes the new smoking poo-poo platter, 8-stack onions, barbecue nachos, chicken wings, and a whole lot of barbecue meats, baby back ribs, lots of sides, and cornbread. The feast keeps on coming. A whole lot of fun for any type of group get-together. Available in dining room or takeout. Smoking Al's, Massapequa Park. For details, call 516-799-4900. And remember, there's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.
There's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.